You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information System for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 11th. I'm Morgan from Drake University, and here's our first story. Ireland honors family for World War II. Iowa woman named chieftain of family's clan. And that word is spelled C-H-I-E-F-T-A-I-N. And this story is written by Pat Kinney of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. The granddaughter and grandniece of Waterloo's five Sullivan brothers killed during World War II has been named chieftain of her family's entire clan by its leaders in Ireland. Kelly Sullivan, a third grade teacher in Cedar Falls, who is the official sponsor of the U.S. Navy destroyer USS The Sullivans, is the first American and the first woman to receive the honor in the clan's 1,000-year history, said clan representative Jim O'Sullivan of County Cork in Ireland. This comes from the people of the area, he said. She has been chosen by the O'Sullivan's people from the countries Cork and Kerry, where her ancestors came from. Kelly Sullivan received the honor during September in Boston. She was presented with a ceremonial gold chain with the family crest as part of the recognition. It was bestowed by the mayors of counties Cork and Kerry in Ireland, from which the clan hails. Kelly Sullivan, the granddaughter of Albert Sullivan, youngest of the five brothers and the only one who married, said she felt her grandfather's and great-uncle's presence there. Here I am in this amazing city I've never had the opportunity to be in with all these great people that are like an Irish family, she said. The thing I keep thinking about is that recording we have at the museum, the Sullivan Brothers, Iowa Veterans Museum in Waterloo, of the boys singing the Irish songs, you know, when Irish eyes are smiling, and I cried, I teared up, as the ceremonial chain was placed around her neck. The Sullivans were really proud of their Irish heritage, Kelly Sullivan said. It was a beautiful sunny day in Boston, and I'm just picturing them looking down from heaven. It's an honor for the whole family in the U.S., she said. I felt very blessed to go and represent the Sullivan family, she said. Members of the O'Sullivan clan visited Boston from Ireland to mark the 300th anniversary of clan members' immigration to Massachusetts and the families on that state and in America. That history, Jim O'Sullivan said, dates back to John Sullivan, who served as a brigadier general in General George Washington's Continental Army in the American Revolution, continuing on through the Sullivan brothers and their namesake vessel today. The O'Sullivan clan goes back to the 11th century, O'Sullivan said. With the advent of British control of their area in about 1602, clan members scattered, some to America, some to Spain. According to the Irish Times, as British rule of Ireland intensified from the 1600s on, Irish surname prefixes such as O and Mick were dropped by some people because it was easier to find work if one did not have an Irish-sounding name. Over the last 50 years, we resurrected the clan chieftain post, O'Sullivan said, and different individuals have held that post over the years. We thought it was appropriate that since some of the original forebears arrived in the States 300 years ago, that we would present the chain to Kelly as an American, and also because of her family history involved with the American military and Navy, he said. The trip included a visit to General John Sullivan's home and the three-masted wooden frigate USS Constitution, Old Ironsides, which fought in the War of 1812. It is the old commissioned ship in the U.S. Navy. I think that's supposed to be, it is the oldest commissioned ship in the U.S. Navy. Sullivan met the ship's commanding officer, Commander Billy June, or BJ Farrell, the ship's first woman commanding officer in its 224-year history. Members of the O'Sullivan clan have maintained ties to Kelly Sullivan and her grandfather and great-uncle's namesake Navy vessel for a quarter century. The clan members, including Jim O'Sullivan's father, attended commissioning ceremonies for the USS The Sullivans in April 1997 at Stapleton Pier, Staten Island, in New York Harbor, in New York City. The ship also visited County Cork in Ireland in 2003, and members of the O'Sullivan clan also traveled to Waterloo in 2008 for the dedication of the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum, part of the Grout Museum District. Jim O'Sullivan said clan members hope the DDG 68 can once again visit Ireland in the not-so-distant future. We're hoping, if things work out, that we'll invite the USS, the Sullivans, in 2 years back to Ireland in this area, but we're not guaranteed anything yet, O'Sullivan said. The ship has served several overseas deployments in recent years, including one during which it was attached to the British Royal Navy. The USS, the Sullivans, a guided missile destroyer based in Mayport, Florida, is the successor vessel to the USS, the Sullivans, DD-537, which Kelly Sullivan's great-grandmother, Aletta Sullivan of Waterloo, sponsored after her 5 sons' deaths. That ship saw service in World War II and Korea, and was decommissioned in 1977 and is now at the Buffalo Naval and Military Park in Buffalo, New York. George Francis Joseph Madison and Albert Sullivan of Waterloo died when their ship, the USS Juno, was torpedoed and sunk on November 13, 1942, following the naval battle of Guadalcanal. All but 14 of the Juno's crew of nearly 700 perished in the actual sinking or at sea on the days that followed. The 5 brothers' deaths are considered the greatest combat-related loss of life by one family at one time in American military history. The brothers enlisted on the condition that they be allowed to serve together, a departure from Navy policy. While attempts were made in Congress as recently as the 1990s to adopt a Sullivan Act, preventing any family members from serving together, no such law was ever formally adopted. For example, multiple family members have served together in Iowa National Guard units in recent years on deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. The brother's uncle, Patrick Henry Sullivan of Harper's Ferry in Alameda County in northeast Iowa, served on the USS the Sullivans DD-537 during World War II. The ship earned 9 battle stars for its service and was known as the Good Samaritan for many rescues of sailors from ships crippled or sunk in battle or storms. Patrick Henry Sullivan narrowly missed serving on the Juno with his nephews. It set sail before he could report for duty. The brother's sister, Genevieve, joined the USS Navy Waves, and she and parents Thomas and Aletta participated in war bond rallies. Goodness, there are quite a few errors in this. They participated in war bond rallies. Kelly's father, Jim Sullivan, now in his 80s and a toddler when his father and uncles perished, also served in the U.S. Navy during the late 1950s and early 1960s. Pat Kinney is a freelance writer and former longtime news staffer with the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. That was just another bit about the author. There are multiple pictures associated with this story. One is of 5 men in U.S. Navy caps who look like they're on a boat. And the caption is, from right to left, Joseph Francis Albert Madison and George Sullivan on the USS Juno in 1942. The next image is of Kelly Sullivan, the woman who was honored. And there's an image of Jim O'Sullivan and let's see what else. A close-up of the medallion bearing the O'Sullivan family crest on the chain Kelly Sullivan received as clan chieftain. And that is a silver medallion that looks like it has like a family crest on it. The next story is titled Young Leaders Learn Real Life Financial Skills Camp. And this does not have an author listed. The inaugural Real World Camp of Southwest Iowa students invited the 18th class of Youth Leadership Council Bluffs to work through a simulation of real world scenarios touching on financials and the economy in which they will one day work. Held November 9th at the Salvation Army, 715 North 16th Street in Council Bluffs, the one-day camp was sponsored by TS Bank in conjunction with the Council Bluffs Chamber of Commerce, New Visions Homeless Services, and the Charles E. Lakin Human Services Campus, according to a news release. Brandon Garrett, Chief of Staff with the City of Council Bluffs, addressed the 22 students with the topic of community challenges. I explained to the students that we have a major housing shortage in Council Bluffs. What we have learned is that nationally, when rental vacancies are below 5-8%, homelessness dramatically increases, Garrett said in the release. The rental vacancy in Council Bluffs is below 2% as of 2021 and is likely to fall even lower. The city is working to alleviate homelessness by increasing the housing supply of all types. This event gave students a chance to meet area professionals in a simulated city with real-life scenarios while working within a budget. The stations included banking, health clinics, rent, utilities, grocery, law enforcement, and state assistance. The real-world camp offers everyday interactions to increase experimental learning. Community members came together to provide a meaningful and impactful program for what we hope will be future leaders in our community, Tracy Drescher, THTS Bank Program Manager, said in the release. Each year, high school juniors are chosen to participate in Youth Leadership Council Bluffs and are charged with producing a slogan. Appropriately, this year's class chose CRE18 Change as their motto. Child care costs, monthly bills, and transportation were the biggest shock to the students and created lively discussions. Weighing the pros and cons of how to navigate adulthood is a key component of the event's curriculum. I think every high school student should have to do this. Heather Beekhuizen, New Visions Homeless Services Community Liaison, said in the release. It really is a powerful experience. When I talked to my son at home last night, he said it was fun, but really frustrating to deal with some of the systems. He said it was just really overwhelming to have to think about all the bills to pay and the scenario of taking care of kids. I think the simulation really sunk in. Outside classroom experiences for students foster growth in money-saving habits and financial behaviors. This financial literacy program acts as a catalyst to help create lasting change, lasting client and community prosperity while enriching our local youth for generations to come. Youth Leadership Council Bluffs is a program of the Council Bluffs Chamber of Commerce designed to develop and educate youth to become socially minded, active young adults. And there is one image associated with this story. The caption is Aaron Trescott with Guild Mortgage and Wayne Wakehouse with TS Bank help at the Real World Camp Simulation at the Salvation Army on Thursday, November 9th, 2023. And the image is of two people sitting at a table, and they are mimicking handing out money from a register like a bank. The next story is titled Zelensky Invited to DC. Biden aims to increase pressure on lawmakers to okay financial help. And this is written by Mark Sherman of the Associated Press. President Joe Biden invited Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, to the White House on Tuesday as the U.S. administration stepped up the pressure on Congress to provide billions more in aid to Kiev in its war with Russia. The visit is intended to underscore the United States' unshakable commitment to supporting the people of Ukraine as they defend themselves against Russia's brutal invasion, the White House said in a statement Sunday. Biden has asked Congress for a $110 billion package of wartime funding for Ukraine and Israel, along with other national security priorities. But the request is caught up in a debate over U.S. immigration policy and border security. Congress has already allocated $111 billion to assist Ukraine, and Biden's budget director, Shalonda Young, said in a letter this past week to House and U.S. Senate leaders that the U.S. will run out of funding to send weapons and assistance to Ukraine by the end of the year. It's time to cut a deal that both sides can agree to, Young said Sunday. Earlier, Secretary of State Antony Blinken defended the emergency sale to Israel of nearly 14,000 rounds of tank ammunition and called for quick congressional approval of the foreign assistance. Israel is in combat right now with Hamas, he said, and we want to make sure that Israel has what it needs to defend itself against Hamas. The tank ammunition and support and related support constitute only a small portion of military sales to Israel, Blinken said, and that the rest remains subject to congressional review. It's very important that Congress's voice be heard on this, he said. Blinken noted that Biden said he is willing to make significant compromises to get the aid package moving. It's something the president is fully prepared to engage on, Blinken said. Meanwhile, battles raged across Gaza on Sunday as Israel indicated it was prepared to fight for months or longer to defeat the territory's Hamas rulers, and a key mediator said willingness to discuss a ceasefire was fading. Israel faces international outrage as its military offensive, with diplomatic support and arms from close ally, the United States, has killed thousands of Palestinian civilians. About 90% of Gaza's 2.3 million people have been displaced within the besieged territory, where UN agencies say there is no safe place to flee. Israel's air and ground war has killed thousands of Palestinians, mostly civilians, since the October 7th attack by Hamas and other militants killed 1,200 people and captured around 240. Over 100 of them were released during a week-long ceasefire late last month. With very little aid allowed in, Palestinians face severe shortages of food, water, and other basic goods. Some observers openly worry that Palestinians will be forced out of Gaza altogether. The next story is titled, Residents Begin Storm Cleanup. Officials say 6 people died, dozens injured when tornadoes hit area. This is written by Kristen M. Hall of the Associated Press. Central Tennessee residents and emergency workers cleaned up Sunday from severe weather storms and tornadoes that killed 6 people and sent dozens more to the hospital, while damaging buildings, turning over vehicles, and knocking out power to tens of thousands. Officials confirmed that 3 people, including a toddler, died after a tornado struck Montgomery County, 50 miles northwest of Nashville, near the Kentucky state line, on Saturday afternoon. About 60 people were treated for injuries at area medical facilities, including 9 transferred in critical condition to a Nashville hospital, said Jimmy Edwards, Montgomery County's director of emergency services. In a neighborhood just north of downtown Nashville, three people were killed Saturday as a result of tornadoes, while 21 total injuries were reported, city officials said. In Nashville, the roof of a church building north of downtown collapsed during the storm, resulting in 13 people being treated at hospitals, Nashville emergency officials said in a news release. They were later listed in stable condition. Clarksville Mayor Joe Pitts said it could be a couple weeks before power is restored to everyone. Residents of the city, about 166,000 people, spent Sunday helping one another dig out from the devastating storms, he said. We know we have people who are suffering because of a loss of life, loss of property, Pitts said. One thing I love about this city is that when someone has a need, we rally around that need. At least 6 tornado tracks were reported Saturday in central Tennessee, according to the National Weather Service. Agency meteorologist Corey Mueller in Nashville said it was sending out tornado tracking teams on Sunday to attempt to confirm these potential tornadoes and calculate their severity. Mueller said it wasn't uncommon for tornadoes to be generated during this time of year. The Metropolitan Nashville Police Department identified victims killed north of downtown as Joseph Dalton, 37, age 37, Floridima Gabriel Perez, age 31, and her son Anthony Elmer Mendez, age 2. Dalton was inside his mobile home when the store tossed it on top of Perez's residence. 2 other children, one in each home, were taken to the hospital with injuries that were not life-threatening, the department said in a statement. Montgomery County officials did not provide the names of the 3 people who died in the Clarksville area. At a news conference with Metropolitan Nashville leaders, Mayor Freddie O'Connell said that over 20 structures had collapsed as a result of Saturday's storm and that countless others have sustained significant damage. Nashville Electric Service executive Teresa Broyles Alpin said electric substations in North Nashville and in nearby Hendersonville suffered significant damage and that outages could last days in some areas. She said it was possible that a widely distributed video showing a fireball in the Saturday evening sky could have been caused by Nashville electric equipment. And there is one image associated with this piece. The caption says, Amber Gardner looks at the debris from a friend's destroyed house in the West Creek Farms neighborhood Sunday in Clarksville, Tennessee. And it shows one woman walking around just a lot of wreckage that seems to have been a house at some point. Next up, Trump won't testify again in civil trial. Donald Trump said Sunday he had decided against testifying for a second time at his New York civil fraud trial, posting on social media a day before his scheduled appearance that he, very successfully and conclusively, testified last month and saw no need to do so again. The former president, the leading contender for the 2024 Republican nomination, had been expected to return to the witness stand Monday as a coda to his defense against New York Attorney General Letitia James's lawsuit. James, a Democrat, alleges Trump inflated his wealth on financial statements used in securing loans and making deals. The case threatens Trump's real estate empire and cuts to the heart of his image as a successful businessman. The next little story is titled Philadelphia Students Protest Antisemitism. Students, lawmakers, and religious leaders joined forces Sunday at a temple in Philadelphia to strongly denounce antisemitism on college campuses and in their communities. The gathering at Congregation Rodef Shalom came one day after University of Pennsylvania President Liz McGill resigned amid criticism over her testimony at a congressional hearing. McGill was unable to say, under repeated questions, that calls on campus for the genocide of Jews would violate the school's conduct policy. I have seen Pennsylvanians take actions big and small, and both matter, to combat antisemitism, Governor Josh Shapiro, a Democrat, said at the event. The next story is actor Ryan O'Neill, star of Love Story, dies at 82. This is written by Anthony McCartney of the Associated Press. Ryan O'Neill, the heartthrob actor who went from a TV soap opera to an Oscar-nominated role in Love Story and delivered a wry performance opposite his charismatic 9-year-old daughter Tatum in Paper Moon, died Friday, his son said. My dad passed away peacefully today with his loving team by his side, supporting him and loving him as he would us. Patrick O'Neill, a Los Angeles sportscaster, posted on Instagram. No cause of death was given. Ryan O'Neill was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2012, a decade after he was first diagnosed with chronic leukemia. He was 82. My father, Ryan O'Neill, has always been my hero, Patrick O'Neill wrote, adding, he is a Hollywood legend, full stop. He meant the world to me. I loved him very much, and I know he loved me too, Tatum O'Neill told People magazine in a statement. I'll miss him forever, and I feel very lucky that we ended on such good terms. Ryan O'Neill was among the biggest movie stars in the world in the 1970s, working cross-genres with many of the era's most celebrated directors, including Peter Bogdanovich on Paper Moon and What's Up, Doc, and Stanley Kubrick on Barry Lyndon. He often used his boyish blonde good looks to play men who hid shadowy or sinister backgrounds behind their clean-cut images. O'Neill maintained a steady television acting career into his 70s in the 2010s, appearing for stints on Bones and Desperate Housewives, but his longtime relationship with Farrah Fawcett and his tumultuous family life kept him in the news. Twice divorced, O'Neill was romantically involved with Fawcett for nearly 30 years, and they had a son, Redmond, born in 1985. The couple split in 1997, but reunited a few years later. He remained by Fawcett's side as she battled cancer, which killed her in 2009 at age 62. With his first wife, Joanna Moore, O'Neill fathered actors Griffin O'Neill and Tatum O'Neill, his co-star in the 1973 movie Paper Moon, for which she won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. He had son Patrick with his second wife, Leigh Taylor Young. Ryan O'Neill had his own Best Actor Oscar nomination for the 1970 tear-jerker drama Love Story, co-starring Ally McGraw, about a young couple who fall in love, marry, and discover she is dying of cancer. The movie includes the memorable but often satirized line, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." The actor had, at times, strained relationships with three of his children, including estrangement from his daughter, squabbles with son Griffin, and a drug-related arrest sparked by a probation check of his son Redmond. The personal drama often overshadowed his later career, although his attempts to reconcile with Tatum O'Neill were turned into a short-lived reality series. O'Neill played bit parts and performed some stunt work before claiming a lead role on the primetime soap opera Peyton Place, which also made a star of Mia Farrow. From there, O'Neill jumped to the big screen with 1969's The Big Bounce, which co-starred his then-wife, Taylor Young, but it was Love Story that made him a movie star. The romantic melodrama was the highest-grossing film of of 1970, became one of Paramount Pictures' biggest hits, and collected over 7 Oscar nominations, including one for Best Picture. It won for Best Music. After Love Story made him a major movie star, O'Neill was considered for seemingly every major leading role in Hollywood. Paramount even pushed for him to star as Michael Corleone in The Godfather before Al Pacino got the part at the insistence of director Francis Ford Coppola. O'Neill then starred for Bogdanovich as a bumbling professor opposite Barbara Streisand in the 1972 screwball comedy What's Up, Doc? So sad to hear the news of Ryan O'Neill's passing, Streisand, who also starred with O'Neill in the 1979 boxing rom-com The Main Event, posted on Instagram. He was funny and charming, and he will be remembered. And the one image with this story has the caption, "Tatum O'Neill left a cast member in The Runaways and her father, actor Ryan O'Neill, posed together at the premiere of the film March 11th, 2010 in Los Angeles." And the image is of a man and a younger woman smiling at cameras on a red carpet. Next up, there are a few little news snippets from the Associated Press that I will read. Account restored. Elon Musk restored the X account of conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, pointing to a poll on the social media platform formerly known as Twitter that came out in favor of the InfoWars host, who repeatedly called the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting a hoax. Vessels targeted. The Chinese Coast Guard targeted Philippine vessels with water cannon blasts Sunday and rammed one of them, causing damage and endangering Filipino crew members off a disputed shoal in the South China Sea, Philippine officials said. Osprey crash. Air Force divers on Sunday recovered the remains of the seventh of the 8 crew members from the U.S. military Osprey aircraft that crashed November 29th off southern Japan during a training mission. Priest attacked. A Sioux City, Iowa man was arrested in the stabbing death of Reverend Stephen Gutzel, a Catholic priest who was attacked over the weekend in a church rectory in a small Nebraska community, authorities said. That was Fort Calhoun. Kier L. Williams, 43, age 43, faces charges of homicide and using a weapon to commit a felony, Washington County Sheriff Mike Robinson said in a statement. Yemen. France said Sunday that one of its warships in the Red Sea was targeted by two drones coming from Yemen. Both were intercepted and shot down. A short statement from the Army's ministry did not say who fired the drones at the French Navy frigate Languedoc on Saturday night. Atlanta shooting. A shooting in Atlanta killed three people and left one victim wounded Saturday evening, police said. The Atlanta Police Department said three victims in their 20s were pronounced dead at the scene, and the fourth was transported to a hospital. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 11th, 2023. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Omaha from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Now I'm going to read some sports stories. This first one is the NFL Roundup. Browns survive Jags late rally. Joe Flacco threw for 311 yards and three touchdowns in his home debut for Cleveland, and the Browns survived a late rally by Trevor Lawrence and the Jacksonville Jaguars for a 31-27 win Sunday. The 38-year-old Flacco, who was only signed 3 weeks ago by the Browns, delivered the kind of performance he had almost annually as a visitor with Baltimore. Flacco went 26 of 45 and improved to 10-2 as a starter in Cleveland. Lawrence played despite spraining his right ankle Monday night. He threw a season-high three interceptions before bringing the Jaguars back in the fourth quarter. Next up, the next game is Bills 20, Chiefs 17. Josh Allen threw for 233 yards with touchdowns running and throwing. The Bills kicked a go-ahead field goal with 1:54 to go, and thanks to a crucial penalty on Chiefs wide receiver Kadarius Toney, Buffalo held on to win in Kansas City. The Chiefs thought they'd taken the lead with less than 2 minutes remaining when Patrick Mahomes hit Travis Kelce over the middle, and the high school quarterback threw far across the field to Toney, who ran the rest of the 49 yards for a touchdown. Only one problem. Toney had lined up offside. The penalty wiped out the play. The next game, Bears 28, Lions 13. Justin Fields threw for a touchdown and ran for another, and host Chicago played its most impressive game of the season, beating NFC North leading Detroit. Receiver J.D. Moore had his first career rushing touchdown and caught a scoring pass to help Chicago win for the third time in four games. Next is Ravens 37, Rams 31, and it went into overtime. Tyland Wallace returned a punt 76 yards for a touchdown in overtime to lift host Baltimore over Los Angeles, snapping the Rams' three-game winning streak. Next game, Jets 30, Texans 6. Zach Wilson threw a pair of second-half touchdown passes in his return from a two-game benching. Host New York shut down C.J. Stroud before Houston's star rookie quarterback left late with a concussion. Oh, goodness. And the Jets ended a five-game losing streak. Wilson was 27 for 36 for 301 yards. Next game, Bengals 34, Colts 14. Jake Browning threw two touchdown passes and ran for another in his second straight outstanding performance for Cincinnati, which pounded Indianapolis at home. Saints 28, Panthers 6. Derek Carr returned from a recent concussion and upper body injuries to throw touchdown passes to Chris Olave and Jimmy Graham and host New Orleans beat hapless Carolina. 49ers 28, Seahawks 16. Debo Samuel scored on a catch and a run as host San Francisco won its 11th straight division game, beating Seattle. Broncos 24, Chargers 7. Russell Wilson threw two touchdowns and Denver won at the Chargers after Los Angeles lost quarterback Justin Herbert due to a finger injury in the first half. Wilson completed 21 of 33 for 224 yards, including a 46-yard touchdown to Cortland Sutton in the third quarter. Vikings 3, Raiders 0. Wow, that is an interesting score. Minnesota and Las Vegas played the lowest scoring NFL game in 16 years. Yeah, with Greg Johnson's 36-yard field goal lifting the Vikings on the road. Buccaneers 29, Falcons 25. Baker Mayfield threw an 11-yard touchdown pass to Kate Otten with 31 seconds remaining, capping a wild fourth quarter that pushed Tampa Bay into a tie for first place in the NFC South by winning in Atlanta. Cowboys 33, Eagles 13. Jack Prescott threw for two touchdowns, Brandon Aubrey made four field goals, and Dallas beat Philadelphia for its 15th straight home win. Aubrey extended his NFL record by going 30 for 30 on field goals to start his career. The next story is titled, Ex-Titan Wycheck, 52, Dies After Home Fall. Three-time Pro Bowler Frank Wycheck, who threw the lateral that started the Music City Miracle, launching the Tennessee Titans' run to the franchise's lone Super Bowl appearance, has died. He was 52. Wycheck died at his Chattanooga home after an apparent fall where he hit his head Saturday morning, according to a statement from his family released through the Legacy Consulting firm. His family said Sunday, with great sadness, that Wycheck was found Saturday afternoon. His family will be following Wycheck's wishes to work with experts for CTE research and ongoing brain injuries, TBI. Funeral services have not been scheduled yet. The next story, thankful Bronny James makes college debut in Southern California loss, written by Beth Harris of the Associated Press. Bronny James showed off his defensive skills in his college debut for Southern California nearly 5 months after he suffered cardiac arrest and expressed gratitude for the doctors and family who supported him. He had 4 points, 3 rebounds, and 2 assists on Sunday, coming off the bench play in front of his superstar father, LeBron James. "I just want to say I'm thankful for everything," Bronny James said afterward in brief comments to a horde of media. He thanked the Mayo Clinic where he received treatment, as well as his parents, siblings, coach Andy Enfield, and his teammates during this hard time in my life. He left without taking any questions. The Trojans lost in overtime to Long Beach State, 84-79. James walked off with his deflated teammates and didn't greet his father, who sat courtside. James logged 16 minutes, including starting the 5-minute extra session, but he wasn't a factor then before coming out for the last time. He was 1 of 3 shooting, hitting a 3-pointer in the second half. His biggest impression came on defense. All of James's rebounds were on the defensive glass, and he had 2 steals. "I thought Bronny played well," Enfield said. "He defended at a high level. He guarded the quick ball handlers on the other team pretty well. James was quick to pass to his teammates, even when it appears he could have taken a shot." Enfield said James's minutes would continue to be monitored by USC's medical staff. He played 6 minutes in the first half when the Trojans led 43-30 at the break. In his second 3-minute stint, James made a huge block on Jaden Jones, who was streaking to the basket on a fast break, riling up the fans. James assisted on a dunk by Vincent, oh my goodness, this last name, Iwuchukwu, spelled Iwuchukwu, who also suffered a cardiac arrest as a freshman. He returned to play 14 games last season. "It's great to see Bronny out there. He's put a lot of work in the gym," Iwuchukwu said. "We talked about the game, and I told him to go out there and have fun." James entered the game for the first time about 7 minutes in, with some in the crowd standing and cheering. He missed his first shot, a 3-point attempt, moments before He tipped the ball away from a Long Beach State player, but the visitors got it back. The possession ended in a shot clock violation for the Beach. James also snagged a rebound. "He makes the right play all the time," said Boogie Ellis, USC's top guard. "Everybody wants a guy like that on their team. He defends well at a high level." LeBron James arrived seconds before the national anthem, holding hands with 9-year-old daughter Zuri, and tapped his son's rear as he passed the Trojans, who were lined up across the court for the anthem. "It was exciting for everybody to see him out there," Enfield said, "and I'm sure his family was the most excited." The NBA was well represented in the game. One of James's teammates, DJ Rodman, the son of Dennis Rodman, who fouled out. The Beach's roster include Clace Poinice, the son of 15-year-old NBA veteran Olden Poinice. James joined his teammates for on-court warm-ups 90 minutes before tip-offs, wearing a white USC shirt and red sweatpants. Students lined up on one side of Galen Center and down an adjacent street, waiting to get inside. Although there were pockets of empty seats in the 10,258-seat arena, James's debut helped the Trojans draw their largest crowd of the season. James suffered cardiac arrest on July 20th during a workout at Galen Center. He was found to have a congenital heart defect that was treatable. James was recently cleared by his doctors and USC medical staff to participate in full contact practice. Previously, he had been limited to working out on his own, doing weights, cardio, and shooting. All right, I'm going to move on to the lifestyle section. The first article is titled "Salute to Summer's Survivors on Gardening," written by Norman Winter of the Tribune News Service. With rains being almost non-existent for much of my region this past summer, many of us have gone back to thinking about tough plants as well as water conservation. I was perusing my photos from last summer and was astounded at the beautiful flowers. While azaleas were flagging or drying over here and hydrangeas wilting over there, some darn tough periwinkles and annuals were strutting their stuff as all-stars of the drought. I have written about many of these over the past couple of years, but never from the standpoint of simply being a tough summer survivor. I'm in the hot, humid Southeast, so I have always picked out flowers that could take the heat, that were beautiful, and that brought in pollinators. Never did I consider drought tolerance. I am usually way more concerned if I have good enough drainage so the plants don't drown. We don't have a drought here. That is until this year. The all-stars of the drought did so well they taught me a lesson. I have been pampering them too much. An example is the new meant-to-be queen nectarine and royal raspberry, a gustache. They relished this past summer so much that they have formed tight clumps, forecasting great things come in spring. The same holds true for upscale red velvet and pink Chanel bee balm, as well as the color-coded Echinacea, spelled Echinacea, all of which have native DNA throughout. One plant that has continuously outperformed all expectations is Augusta lavender heliotrope. I have it planted in a horrid location on the side of the slope that is impossible to water even when it is not in drought, but it thrived and is even blooming now in December. Augusta lavender heliotrope is simply amazing and perennial in zone 8 and warmer. The luscious lantanas may be the toughest flowers on the planet, and the captains of our all-stars of the drought team. I am in year 4 with luscious Royal Cosmo, Marmalade, Golden Gate, Citron, and Citrus Blend. I've never seen one wilt. They seem to celebrate the heat and drought of 2023 with their gorgeous blooms. Rockin' Playin' the Blues Salvia was a champion in every location I planted it, as well as in those in which my son James used it. I wrote this on December 4th, and they are blooming. The blue is simply the most riveting color in the landscape. It stands to reason that this is a rugged perennial in zone 7 and warmer, as both of its parents are native to Mexico, Texas, and New Mexico. I've been guilty of pampering my award winners, but will reel in the luxuriant water supply on all of these next year. While these all-stars of the drought taught me something, a frightening thought occurred to me. What if it is like this next year? What if we are in a period like Colorado found themselves to be in the 1970s? This is precisely what led to the Denver Water Department developing the term Xeriscape in 1981, alongside with its 7 core principles. Most of us have felt that droughts will never really affect us. Unfortunately, many are there now, and no one knows when it will subside. Should we reconsider our landscape design, plant selection, and irrigation methods for 2024? You bet. The all-stars of the drought I mentioned above are a good place to start for beauty, toughness, and pollinators. Next up is a television Q&A written by Rich Heldenfels of the Tribune News Service. Question submitted by reader. Now that the COVID epidemic is behind us, I'm hoping that they will resume production of new episodes of Antique Roadshow. Do you know whether the show will return? Answer. The long-running PBS series will begin a new season January 8th. The show says the season will feature presentations at distinctive historic venues, including Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, Old Sturbridge Village in Sturbridge, Massachusetts, LSU Rural Life Museum in Baton Rouge, North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh, and Stan Hewitt Hall and Gardens in Akron, Ohio. Next question. Is the actor who plays Sonny's right-hand man, Brick, on General Hospital the same person as the Stephen Smith who does Stephen's A-List for ESPN, or are they brothers? They look so much alike. Answer. The Stephen A. Smith, known for his work on ESPN, is also the Stephen A. Smith, who played Brick in about 36 episodes of General Hospital. Smith told talk show host Tamron Hall that he has been a soap opera fan since childhood. He first did a cameo as a reporter on General Hospital in 2007. Okay, next I'm going to read some obituaries. I know these are usually read earlier in the program, but I just found them in Saturday's large paper, so I'm going to read those. Dennis Toby Olaf Walter, who lived from December 14th, 1945 to December 6th, 2023. Dennis Toby Olaf Walter, age 77 years. Dennis passed away in his sleep on Wednesday, December 6th, 2023, in Council Bluffs, Iowa, after a long battle with dementia and a fast decline due to aggressive lung cancer. He was born December 14th, 1945, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, to the late Otto and Violet Walter. Dennis graduated from the Missouri Valley High School in 1964 and went on to serve his country in the U.S. Navy. He enlisted from 1964 to 1968 and was on the USS Dixie during the Vietnam War. After his honorable discharge, he married Vicki Henderson in 1978. He enlisted in the Naval Reserve from 1984 to 2001. Dennis was a welder and boilermaker slash mechanic working for Union Pacific Railroads and Tyson Foods. He was incredibly hardworking and loved motorcycles, dancing, and spending time with his family. Dennis is preceded in death by his sister Maxine and his niece Lynn. He is survived by his wife Vicki, son Eric Walter, daughter Carrie Walter, grandchildren Galen, Audra, and Magnolia, sisters Galen, Karen, and Luann, and other loving family and friends. Memorial service, Tuesday, December 12th, 11 a.m., with a visitation starting an hour prior at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Please direct memorials to the Wounded Warrior Project. The next obituary is for Michael Anthony Brian Nelson, who lived from August 9th, 2000 to December 4th, 2023. Survived by grandmother Tamala Miller, siblings Josh Brandenburg, Tommy Brandenburg, Lily Schreiner, great-grandmother Karen Nelson, great-aunt Patty Sarah Gusa, birth mother Amy Nelson, aunts and uncles William Miller, Elise Manimo, and Alex Keller. He is also survived by numerous cousins and great-aunts and uncles. He was preceded in death by his mother, Lori Brandenburg, and great-grandfather, William Nelson. Funeral services, Tuesday, December 12th, 2023, at 11 a.m. at Harvey Funeral Home Chapel in Plattsmouth, Nebraska. Visitation will be held prior to the service from 9 to 11 a.m. Memorials to the Humane Society in Council Bluffs. Brian P. Harvey Funeral Home. The address is 1408 8th Avenue, Plattsmouth, Nebraska, zip code 68048. The website is www.bpharveyfuneralhome.com. That concludes the obituaries from Saturday's paper, period. There are no obituaries in Monday's paper. Next up is an article called Gift of Gadget, Six Ideas for the Techies on Your Holiday List, written by Jim Roseman of the Tribune News Service. The holiday shopping season is in full spring. Here are six gadgets I've been testing that would make great Christmas gifts. Note, the prices listed here are manufacturers' suggested retail pricing, and you may find them cheaper when you shop. Lafin Swift High Speed Hair Dryer, $200 at laifentech.com or Amazon. The Lafin Swift Hair Speed Dryer looks a lot like the more expensive Dyson hair dryer. Air intake is at the bottom of the handle. Hafen says it can dry your hair faster with zero heat damage. It's described as a negative ion blow dryer, and it has an 110,000 RPM brushless motor. The Swift has three temperature settings, cool, warm, and hot, and two speed settings. Its slim size makes it easy to store and pack in a suitcase. Although its low speed could be a little lower, the Swift is very quiet and certainly gets the job done quickly. And the image is of the hair dryer, and it just looks like it's on a stick, and it has a big hole, and the hair goes in the hole, and that's how it dries. The next suggestion is Exter Grid Backpack, $195 at ekster.com. The Extra Grid backpack is like a suitcase and a backpack had a baby. It's a great-looking bag made from recycled plastic water bottles with a water-resistant body and waterproof zippers. The main compartment opens 180 degrees like a suitcase. Inside, there is a padded compartment for a laptop up to 16 inches. There are stretchy zippered pockets inside along the top and bottom. The rest of the interior is one big open space. The grid backpack has many useful compartments, some hidden, such as a thin side pocket, perfect for your boarding pass. And the image is of a odd, flat, big-looking backpack that is gray. The next product is Dabson DBS-T300 Plus Portable Power Station, $100,799 at dabbsson.com. This thing is a 1,330 watt-hour expandable power station. Can power your entire home in the event of an electrical outage. It's great to keep on hand for emergencies too. The DBS-T300 Plus can recharge from a water outlet in a little over an hour, or charge from solar panels. It can run a refrigerator for 19 hours, a 10-watt lamp for 350 hours, and charge your laptop 83 times. Next up is titled EZ Quest Ultimate USB-C Multimedia Hub Adapter. And this is $99 from ezq.com or Amazon. The Ultimate USB-C Multimedia Hub Adapter from EZQuest is a great solution for laptops with only USB ports. This adapter has 13 ports, and it can provide up to 100 watts of pass-through power. Ports include two HDMI VGA Gigabit Ethernet, two USB-A, and two USB-A3. There is also a pass-through USB-C power input. The next thing is the Poly Voyager Surround 80UC headset for $450 from bhphotovideo.com. I'm surprised at how good the sound is, as how good my voice sounds to callers on the Poly Voyager Surround 80UC headset, considering there is no boom microphone. And this is a pair of headphones that has a microphone in it as well, it seems. And the last thing on this list is a Dangbei Mars 1080p laser projector, $999 at us.dangbei.com. The Dangbei Mars projector has 2,100 lumens of brightness, which means it can be used in a room with windows during the day. The maximum image size is 180 inches. It has autofocused, can adjust its image screen to fit your screen, and square up the edges of an image. The Mars has two 10-watt good but not great speakers built in. You'll likely want to connect external speakers. And the image of this just looks like a black box to me. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 11th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Morgan from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.